Welcome to Theology on Tuesday, everyone. We're so glad that you are here. Thank you all for already grabbing a seat. We are delighted to be back again at Henry's on the Market. My name is Justin. If this is your first time here, welcome. And this is my good friend, Brian McGreevy, who's back from his adventurous travels, which hopefully we'll hear a little bit about. And we're excited. Yes, I can't wait to hear about it. But we are excited for the cooler weather that seems to be happening in this fall and all that's getting ready in the next few months. So we're excited also for tonight and our topic, which is going to be about the role of imagination, which I'm really excited about. You should see these little sheets of paper around the room. Those are important, especially if this is your first time. You'll need to see those because you can scan a QR code on the top there, and at any point this evening, you can submit any question whatsoever, and Alexandra is going to be moderating the questions tonight. Thank you, Alexandra. And so that's a really important sheet. You'll see on the top there the QR code. Go ahead and click on that if you want to submit a question. You'll also see our email list if you want to sign up and stay up to date on all things related to Theology on Tuesday. The other thing that you'll see there on the other side is a group called Holy City Life, which came out of Theology on Tuesdays. A number of y'all were like, hey, this is every other week on Tuesday. We would like something a little bit more, especially kind of fellowship oriented, just getting together. And so thankfully, Alexandra, who's going to be moderating our questions, and Meredith, who's right next to her, they head up what's called Holy City Life. And you can stay up to date by joining that GroupMe that's on there and be in the know on the activities that happen usually on the off weeks of Theology on Tuesday, which is a great way to continue to meet folks and just build some community, which is something we really like here. So,
indeed.
Anything else in terms of announcements that I'm forgetting?
I would say the only other thing is that if you are looking for a church home, obviously Justin and I are both at St. Philip's, and we have the kickoff for our church year this Sunday. Even if you're not looking for a church home, you might want to play hooky this one week because Rally Sunday, our incredible music department really blows the roof off, so we'll have brass and bagpipes and all sorts of stuff, and a free barbecue lunch afterwards. So that's at 10:30 Sunday. Come check that out. And then next week, on Wednesdays, our Wednesday service in the middle of the week starts up again, and there will be a class that I'm teaching after that, which I'm super excited about, that is The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And so that is going to be, there's a supper, well, there's a service at 5:30, a free supper at 6:30 that's really good food, and then class will be 7:15 to 8:15. But you don't have to go to St. Philip's or be a Christian or anything to come to that. We'd love to have any of you.
That's awesome, yes. And actually, one of the things that we've been delighted to have for, this is now our fourth year, I think, of doing this.
Really?
Yeah, we started in 2021 in the summer, so it's been at least three. I think this is now our fourth year, which is kind of wild. It feels
crazy.
Just like yesterday. But
you still look so young.
I know. It's surprising. But we've had, over the course, I mean, probably dozens of churches that are represented. So yep. One of the things that we love about this is you can go anywhere or nowhere. We're just delighted that you are here. And
absolutely.
So this is an opportunity, wherever you come from, whatever your background is, we're just delighted that you're able to join us. So tonight, let's talk about the imagination. Well, actually, no, before we get into that, I just want to know, give me some highlights of your time, because you went, I know you were all up and down the Eastern Seaboard pretty much, but over in England especially, because you, if you're new, Brian is like the expert on C.S. Lewis, probably in the United States, but you're being too
humble. I'm the enthusiast about C.S. Lewis.
Maybe that.
But
well, give me some highlights.
That is a dangerous bottle to open, Justin. I'll be very brief. I would say that one of the major highlights was there was a world-class exhibition on C.S. Lewis that Simon Harbin, who is a professor at Oxford that has Lewis's old job, was mounting, and that was focused on Lewis's words and Lewis's worlds. So it was like the perfect thing for imagination. And he had been, he had just found all these things that nobody knew about, that had never been shown before. And being able to be there, and he took me through when it was closed to the public and like opened the cases and took out these things, and it was incredible. so much better. So many people were in London for the Taylor Swift concert. This was so much better. So much better.
Hands down.
But it was awesome. And yeah, so that was my thing. And he also, as part of this, he had written a new book about C.S. Lewis. And people are writing books about Lewis all the time. But this one is actually really great and got great reviews because it actually has new material in it. So it was just super exciting to be part of all of that. And it was in the 40s, and I had to wear sweaters and coats and sit by a fire in August.
Yeah, not exactly what was going on here in Charleston.
No.
So. Welcome back. And so you were kind of delving into Lewis's world over there in England, and I was over here, and we were thinking about our next topic, and we kind of came at this one from two very different angles. Lewis has a lot to talk about when it comes to the role of the imagination. C.S. Lewis heard the Chronicles of Narnia. That's who we're talking about, the author of those. But he also wrote some of the best works of nonfiction as well. One of the classic cases for defending the Christian faith, Mere Christianity, he was the author of that. So he wrote a lot of different genres, and he had a lot to say on the imagination. I was coming at this because I've got a two-year-old who is just all of a sudden the floodgates have opened in her mouth and mind, and she is talking about mermaids and unicorns at the same time, and they're doing all sorts of things. And so the imagination is one of those things that's very much in front of me and in my world right now. But we thought, you know, the imagination has a lot for both children and adults. Mm-hmm. And this quote that I got from Lewis, I was looking for my phone earlier, that's why, but he said, reason is the natural organ of understanding, but imagination is the organ of meaning. Reason is the natural organ for understanding, but imagination is the organ of meaning. And our entire time could be unpacking what that means.
Yes.
And why that's important. But maybe define what imagination is, and maybe we can dive into some of what he's talking about there.
Yeah, well, I think there are so many different ways you can understand imagination, but I think some of the key parts of imagination would be transcending what is your present reality in terms of what you can think about, and a sensory expanding. Things that appeal to your senses are part of imagination, where it's unusual tastes or unusual things that you can see or unusual things that you can feel coming at you. Unusual emotions that you might not normally experience. It's closely related to the idea of fantasy.
But they're not the same.
But they're not the same, exactly. And imagination is one of the things that is distinctly part of what makes us human and made in the image of God. And so imagination in that sense is sacred. And part of the reason that I'm so excited to get to talk about this, and we're never going to cover everything that there is to be said about this tonight, but part of the reason I think it's so important is we live in what is increasingly a technocratic age that tries to push everything that is the realm of the imaginary down and wants to focus on technology and facts and all of that. But I think there's a rebellion incipient, especially in people in your generation, that is very encouraging to me. Like, I meet so many people who are in their 20s who love the Chronicles of Narnia, who love the Lord of the Rings, who love these kinds of things where they are works of the imagination, where there is beauty and truth and goodness and chivalry and all of these things that are not really part of our culture anymore. Yeah. So I think that our imagination allows us to tap into that part of the way that we are made in God's image.
Yeah. And I think that's really important, going back to, I think so often we associate the imagination with make-believe and things, and that's certainly part of it, with fantasy, make-believe, that sort of thing. And studies will show this is really important for children, right? And as you just talked about with technology and screens, there's all sorts of studies that show that diminishes directly correlating to the amount of imagination.
Yes.
Imagination and the skills that you get through imagination and free play, especially. Mm-hmm. All of that is so important and so good for children. And I'm around a lot of young parents who are kind of dealing with that as well, making sure that their children actually can lean into imagination. But, you know, what would you say to folks who are, you know, their imagination, if they're thinking about it purely in terms of
make-believe, why would that be important? And how would you counter what they're saying in terms of, well, the imagination is so much bigger than just make-believe?
Yeah, I would say that it is really important to cultivate if you want to live a fully human life. I think that if you do not cultivate your imagination and seek to grow in that and then to apply that into your faith journey, if you're a Christian, that you are just missing out on what God has for you. You're living a diminished existence. I don't mean to judge anyone. but my audiovisual exhibit tonight is my little friend here. Does anybody know who this is? Oh, y'all are so good. Flat Stanley. I asked somebody at the office today about Flat Stanley, and they said, isn't that a frog? And I was like, no. Flat Stanley. So Flat Stanley, if you have the same elementary school teacher I did, at the end of the school year, you would each get Flat Stanley, and he would go with you on your summer vacation. And your job, if you were growing up when I was, which none of you were because nobody's that old, which you had to go and get a Polaroid picture taken of yourself with Flat Stanley at Niagara Falls or the Empire State Building. And Flat Stanley got to go all these places. But Flat Stanley, if he turns sideways, he's gone. There's not much to him. He lives a flat, two-dimensional life. And I think in the culture that we live in today, it is all too easy to begin to live a flat, two-dimensional life that is defined by social media and your job, and that your sense of wonder and joy is crushed out of you. And that is no way to live. And God, I love the verse in the Gospel of John where Jesus is talking about Satan's designs on you. And he says, Satan, the thief, comes to steal and kill and destroy. But I, Jesus, come that you may have life and have it abundantly. Jesus didn't come for you to live like Flat Stanley. And a lot of that is tapping into your imagination and cultivating a sense of wonder. And there's a great line in the Chronicles of Narnia and the Voyage of the Dawn Treader. How many of y'all have read any of the Chronicles of Narnia? Okay, that's good. Yay. The rest of you, you have something to look forward to.
But they can join your class.
Yes, they could. But in the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, there's this place where they interact, the characters Eustace, and this is an aside, one of the greatest first lines of any book. There was a boy named Eustace Clarence Scrub, and he almost deserved it.
Yeah.
Such a great line. But Eustace was obnoxious. And so they're on this wonderful voyage, and he meets, this is a big fancy word, an anthropomorphized star. A star that has embodied, that has personality and a name, named Ramandu. And so he introduces himself to Eustace. And Eustace is kind of a little snotty know-it-all kid. And he's like, in our world, a star is just a big ball of flaming gas. And so Ramandu says, my son, even in your world, that is not what a star is, but only what it is made of. And I think that whole idea, if you think when you look at the night sky, which is something we need to do more often, and look at the beauty of the starry heavens, and think about the way that people have been drawn to the stars and what they represent, and sort of the mythology and imagination around that, that's so much richer than thinking it's a ball of flaming gas. But we live in a culture that tends toward that.
Yeah, and in fact, since, okay, I realized in this topic we can go very philosophical in some of this. I kind of went off the deep end this week looking at it, but...
You think you did.
I can only imagine what you did, but the whole notion of modernism, right? We're enlightened, we're going to use science, and everything is going to have a rational explanation, simply cause and effect. We live in this material, cold world, and that was the shift in the way people generally thought of the world as a cosmos, something that had life and meaning and purpose all bound up to it. Now it's simply a cold, dark universe where there is no like inherent meaning in it. And that's kind of the shift that you're talking about, where today we tend to look at these things through reason, right? And we're but if that's the only way we're looking at it is just this matter and stuff, that is deeply shallow. It's very flat, right? Mm-hmm. And so the thing that is so important about imagination is actually reason, and this is going back to Lewis's quote, reason is understanding, like how we understand things, but how we get meaning comes from the stories that we tell ourselves, right? And those stories begin in fantasy or in childhood, play and imagination, like all imagination and story, they go hand in hand, because that's kind of the grid that reason works off of. Like you have to filter what you see and how you understand it through some lens of meaning, right? And that meaning is formed by your imagination.
Yes.
And the stories that we read, the stories that we tell one another, they form us far more than the kind of like just abstract studies that we do or whatever. They're always going against a backdrop of some fundamental story that we're holding to. And if you think of why Lewis is so beloved today, it's not just because of reasoned arguments like Mere Christianity and things like that, but because of fiction and the way he tells stories. And in those stories, you see morality, you see friendship, you see dignity and meaning, all of those things that come together. And I think that's why people in this day and age that we're in love Tolkien and Lewis, is because those are stories that resonate with what we know to be true from our experience and our loves, that just kind of a cold, naturalistic understanding of the world can't really explain.
Yes, that's exactly right. And there is a great quotation that Lewis says. I mean, he's talking about how people, even when Lewis was writing in the 1950s and early 1960s, there are people that said children shouldn't read stories that have dragons in them because the children would be scared and they wouldn't be able to sleep at night, and that they needed to only read things that they would be comfortable with. And Lewis really pushed back about that. And he says that, in fact, there's something ludicrous about the idea of educating a generation that is born to the KGB, which that doesn't exist anymore, but the KGB is like the SS for Nazis. The KGB was the assassins secret service in Soviet Russia. That if you live in the age of the KGB and the atomic bomb, why should you be worried about imaginary dragons? And he says, since it is so likely that children will in fact meet cruel enemies in their lives, let them at least have heard of brave knights and heroic courage. Otherwise, you're making their destiny not brighter, but darker. And he says, when I was 10, I read fairy tales in secret, and would have been ashamed if I had been found doing so. Now that I'm 50, I read them openly. When I became a man, I put away childish things, including the fear of childishness and the desire to be very grown up. And I think there's a deep truth in that, that what's called heroic literature, which most children, people my age, grew up with heroic literature, tales of courage and rescuing the damsel in distress, or you know, those kinds of things. But the idea is that that teaches you things about virtue. And the other thing about the use of your imagination and imagining these worlds that you would enter into through story is it helps you to build empathy. And I'm sorry to say that, unfortunately, your generation, according to every social scientist, is the most empathy deficient generation since people have started measuring them. And it's not because people have decided to go out and say, I've decided to become cold and unfeeling and unable to empathize with others. It's because there's so much in our culture that tells you that you are the center of the world and you don't enter into other people's experience or walk in their footsteps. And what good imaginative literature allows you to do is to get deeply involved in a story where you care about the character and you care about what happens and you want it to all work out for them. And so you get invested in that and it builds in you that skill of seeing through someone else's eyes. And that is one of the things that's so important in imagination. And that's one of the things that's beautiful in little children when they're imagining, because that is part of the way that they begin to build some understanding and some empathy. And I just had a deep dive with this because we haven't had little children in our household for a long time, but my son and his wife went to the Olympics for a week, and we had their 8, 6, and 4-year-old for a week, and that was eye-opening. but you know, one of the things that was great is that I don't know if their parents had told them or what it was, but they were really working on being encouraging. It was so interesting, and their granddad name for me is Boo. So we were going to get ice cream one night, and we're driving along, and the 4-year-old John Henry from the back seat's like, "Boo, you are doing a great job driving." And I was like, "He's got some empathy going on. This is a beautiful thing." But the other thing that resonated with me from that time is that I'd started reading the oldest one, Jackson, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, about 2 years ago when he had just turned 6. And for a variety of reasons, we had to stop. And so when we were at his house, he was like, "Could we read that Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe book again?" I was like, "Twist my arm." and I said, "But we probably are going to have to start at the beginning," because I said, "It's really important that you know sort of who the characters are and all of that and get that straight, because we've been about 4 chapters in." And he was like, "Well, we don't need to start over." And I was like, "Well, yeah, we actually probably do." And he's like, "No, we don't. I know exactly where we were." And I was like, "Do not. That was 2 years ago." And I was like, "Okay, so where were we?" He said, "Well, we were at the part where the witch had just made the Turkish delight for Edmund, and it was enchanted, and she had said he needed to come back and bring his brothers and sisters with him, and that her house was in the distance between the two hills." All of that is in one paragraph, and he knew exactly where it was. And that was because that story had grabbed him. And the fact that he could remember that for 2 years, that was incredible.
The power of story, right?
Yeah.
That's amazing. But I want to go back to something you said a moment ago, which kind of shocked me, and I don't know if it shocked you, but the generation today being the least empathetic, that I would think that so many of the young folks that I know would say that can't be true, because they often present as very empathetic, right? My hunch in that is the way that we relate to one another now is by either text messages or social media, Snapchat, whatever, like sound bites, little bits and pieces. And the thing about imagination and story is it takes a while, and it's something that actually requires you to be drawn in over time. Mm-hmm. And literature especially it's important to kind of lean into that to be able to truly empathize and not just superficially,
yes.
Right? And so my hunch is probably that's where.
And that's a virtue signal.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's one of the key things for development, right? Is you're learning social skills and especially the difference of perspective. When you're reading widely, you're using imagination. You know, my daughter's got, she's got a mom and like a little boy, and she's telling, but she's in doing that, using her imagination of what must this child be thinking? What must mm-hmm. this mom be thinking? And how they relate to one
right.
another. And that teaches empathy.
Right. Which so is amazing.
It's great. And it's also a challenge now where we have so much technology, not to just make it easy and put that in front of her, but actually require the open space. This is one of the things we often say in our house, and we'll get to, I'll get off the children in a moment, but like, your boredom is a gift.
Yes.
Your boredom is a gift. And I think that's true for adults as well. What you do with that time that is unplanned, where
yes.
you don't have, I mean, it's so easy, right, to go to screens or whatever it is, or to fill it up, but to have the time and the space that you're not going to structure things and see what happens. Often prayer becomes a natural thing in that space, I've found. But
yeah, and I think that whole idea is closely related to the concept of wonder. And wonder is one of those beautiful words that to me, when I think of the word wonder, it always reminds me of two different things. One is wondering at the majesty and the glory and the beauty of the kingdom of God, but also that whole idea of wonder when you see something that is just spectacular. And we live in a place that is beautiful, in case you haven't noticed that. And when you look at the sunset over a marsh, over water at the end of the summer, and look at all those colors and the light on the gently swaying grass and the marsh and the water scintillating, it's just it's so beautiful, and having a sense of wonder about how beautiful that is, and stop looking at your phone long enough to be able to actually engage with this glorious nature that's in front of you. But part of the problem for us, and for me even, is that we don't wonder about anything anymore. If we don't know the answer to something, we just Google it.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't sit around and think about it or contemplate it or ask other people what they think. We just Google it, and then we know. But do we really? We think we know, but we might not. And so I think that cultivating that sense of wonder is really important. There's a great, since I bash technology, I'll now say something good about technology. There's a wonderful, if you're really into this imagination topic and you're a nerd like I am, I would highly recommend something called On Fairy Stories, which is a lecture that J.R.R. Tolkien gave back in the 1930s. And it is incredible. But he talks about why fantasy and imagination are so important, particularly when you live in a world that seems to be racing toward its own destruction. And he was writing this right during the time that Hitler was coming to power in Germany. So he knew what he was talking about in terms of what was going on in the world. But in this essay, he talks about that imagination and fairy stories, which by that he means fantasy, anything that's really imaginative, has several functions for us. One, he says, is recovery. And what he means by that is recovering what is actually true. Recovering, because in a fantastical world like Middle Earth or Narnia, it can be structured in such a way that good and evil are clearly differentiated from each other. That you see deeds of virtue and beauty and love and mercy that are happening. And that you can recover your understanding when you start getting confused. He also says it's good for escapism, and that escapism is not always bad. He said if you live in a place that is really dark, being able to escape to a place where right is elevated and wrong is looked down upon, that that's healthy for your soul and for your mind. And then he also says it's good for consolation, that in those times when we get discouraged, when you read a story and you see somebody who is battling against the odds, and then somehow, unbelievably, good triumphs over evil, and they do actually all live happily ever after, that that is a beautiful thing. And sometimes our souls need to hear that. When we're in a dreary, hard place in life, hearing that consolation is important, because we know if we're Christians, that that consolation actually awaits us in the kingdom of God, and it's a small way of beginning to live into that.
Yeah, that's so good. I think going back to what you just said about the role of the imagination, and it's almost like recalibrating. Like the, you're
yes,
talking about escaping.
Exactly. Yeah.
When you're stuck in a world, especially as polarized as we are and confused as what is right and wrong, to lift up out of the muck and the mire and to reorient, recalibrate to
yeah.
what is truly good and what is truly bad. And,
yeah.
and I think some of the best imaginative stories do that well.
Yes.
But going back, I think just to wrap up, there are a couple things we should talk about. I wanted to go a little bit more into the first thing you said about the relation between the imagination and truth. I think that was big for Lewis, right? Where it wasn't just what is imaginative is false. In fact, one of my favorite things, was it Lewis or was it Dorothy Sayers who was talking about myth became fact?
Lewis.
That was Lewis.
Yes.
Okay. Boy, we're just on Lewis tonight, but that's great. But he was basically talking about, again, pushing back on what we tend to think about the imagination being make-believe or false. He saw the Christian story as so highly imaginative, but deeply true. It's rooted in history. And make no mistake, when we're talking about the imagination, we're also talking about it's in relation to Christianity, which is a historical event, an actual fact. And yet those go together.
Yes.
How does the imagination and what is true go together? More?
Yeah,
can you speak into
I think that?
That
is such a great thing. We could spend hours on that. But the basic concept of that is that God himself is the essence of what is true with a capital T, beautiful with a capital B, and good with a capital G. And he is beyond us because we are Flat Stanley. And he's God. He's living in far broader dimensions than we ever will. And so in order to be able to begin to get our heads and our hearts around the fullness of his beauty, we have to be able to use our imagination. And so that is why myth and poetry can both be so important, because they draw us into something that moves our hearts because it's so beautiful. And Lewis was, part of what converted him was when he was walking on Addison's Walk, which is in Magdalen College in Oxford, one night with Tolkien and another friend, Dyson, after they'd had this dinner. And Lewis was still an evangelical atheist at this point, but he was a medievalist, a very fine medieval scholar. And Tolkien started pushing him and said, you love the idea of all of these myths. You love the Greek myths. You love all of these other myths. And they're so beautiful to you, and you think they're so poignant. And he said, what you need to understand is that Christianity is the most beautiful myth with a capital M of all. And the reason it's the most beautiful one is it's the only one that's true with a capital T, where it actually happened, where the Word became flesh and walked like we're walking on this walk. And that was what led to Lewis, after that conversation, going back and kneeling by his bed and praying and saying he was the most reluctant and dejected convert in all of England.
And what I love about that, and what's really helpful if you're a Christian, is that that made sense, the way he thought about all the pagan stories, all the different religions of the world, which do, if myth became fact, the way that you just explained that, right, as he's walking with Tolkien, what he realized at that point is the goodness that some religions touch on in the stories that aren't explicitly Christian still have a lot of really good and truth in them,
right,
but they're fulfilled in the ultimate story. It's the
yes.
same thing today in Hollywood. Some of the, you know, the Marvel movies, these various things, all the great stories that we read and watch, movies, they tap into this ultimate true story of what Jesus, who he is, and
right.
what this rescue mission he's been on. And we should probably wrap up. I want to just say quickly, how does this imagination practically help, and what are some things we can do to grow in our imagination as we sum up? The thing that, that I want to suggest is actually not through reading, I mean, it was certainly reading a lot of stories, but I think it's also true the imagination can change what you love, and it gives you a plausible vision of your life, right? So if you think about reason and you're understanding things in your mind, your imagination helps you see life in a certain way. It makes it visible to you. And I think so often, and you take, for instance, right now, the most probably controversial thing I can think of for young adults is the idea of, like, if God calls me to not have sex outside of marriage, to be celibate, right? That is not a plausible vision for my life. And it's because we don't have a full imagination.
Right.
We don't have a vision. We don't know the stories of what flourishing can look like practically in areas like that. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I was in college reading biographies of people who were actually living a kind of life that was far more courageous and noble than I was living. And it helped create that plausible vision in my imagination for what I wanted my life to look like. It helped to really tell a better story than the stories that the world were telling.
Yeah.
So, anything you would add to that as to like what you would encourage people growing in the imagination or for their Christian faith?
Yeah, I think a couple of things. One is to get off your screens. I think one of the best things that you can do, and it's interesting, Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, when he's talking about anxiety, when he says, do not be anxious, he always follows it with, look at the birds of the air, look at the lilies of the field. There is a resonance in the beauty of God's creation that will fire your sense of wonder if you will slow down and actually look at it. Like, this sounds really stupid, but if you will find a tree or a flower that you think is beautiful and just go stand in front of it for a while and look at it and realize that that tree or that flower is actually pulsing with life, and that it was designed by the Creator's hand, and that it is a miracle that out of this brown, dead-looking seed this flower or this tree can grow, and spend some time just thinking about the wonder of that, or looking at the night sky. All of those kinds of things are living into the beauty of music. There are all sorts of things like that, but slowing down and taking time to actually learn to see is, I think, hugely important in this. And also thinking about the wonder of the other people that you meet, and to realize that each person is made in the image of God, and there's this incredible, beautiful mystery in this person that is worth getting to know. And to begin to see people that way instead of as commodities just makes a huge difference. And I have a whole stack of books here that I won't go into, but they'll be up here. I would highly recommend all of them, especially one called If I Had Lunch with C.S. Lewis. It's written by Alistair McGrath, who is an Anglican priest, who is one of the smartest men in the world. He holds a dual chair in religion and science at Oxford. He has 3 PhDs in molecular biology, theology, and I think maybe astrophysics or something like that. I can't even remember what they are. But he is a genius, but he is so deeply Christian and one of the most profound writers about why we need to recover the imagination, and he uses Lewis as a proxy to help us understand that.
Yeah. How are we doing on questions? Great. Let's jump in.
In case you can't tell, we could talk for hours, or at least I could. Justin has been very patient with me.
Hello. Yep.
All right.
So, first question. Any advice for writing good children's fiction that's not explicitly Christian, but also doesn't, quote unquote, check the boxes in current literature, like gender, identity, race, etc.?
I think the whole idea that anyone would even be interested in writing children's literature is really exciting to me. If that was you, please, if you, and I'm going to give a plug for social media here, believe it or not, find the group that is called the Rabbit Room on social media, which is part of Andrew Peterson's ministry in Nashville. And it is a community of writers and artists who are trying to do exactly those kinds of things. And I think there is so much room to do what Lewis and Tolkien did, which is not exactly explicitly Christian, but is leaning into Christian ideals and virtues. And I think creating beautiful stories that reflect virtue is something that will attract anyone. I have to say, children's literature is really bad.
Abysmal.
These days. I mean, the fact that Captain Underpants is one of the 5 most popular books.
It's awful.
It's just terrible. And there are all these books, like...
It's so stunted, and I mean, just everywhere.
I was looking at a children's book, and staff recommendations. One of these books was on farting. And I was like, well, that's ennobling.
Well, it's like the comedy that, like, once you get to that level, it's like the lowest level of comedy where you're appealing to that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's really not good, honestly, right? But, like, and that's true, I think, for literature. I cut you off, sorry.
Well, the other thing I would say, and this is from Lewis. Lewis has a great thing about, somebody wrote him and asked that same question, and he wrote a wonderful answer that I'm not going to repeat all of it. But part of what he said was, write about what you love. Write about what you love, because if you write about what you love, that passion is going to convey to your readers.
And I would add on, agree with everything you just said, and I would say Lewis would agree with this too. Read the old stories. Yeah. They're not concerned about checking the boxes. So read the old stories, medieval literature, random Icelandic literature like Lewis and Tolkien liked, and do what they did, actually, which was to meet together, find like-minded people who are interested in doing that sort of thing too, and or pray for it if you can't find it, and seek to do that in community with others, and that should help you.
Yes.
That was the Inklings. That's what they did. Next.
What are a few must-read books that point toward theology would you recommend for us?
You have to plug your book, please. Not your book.
Which
because
one?
You didn't write it. The one you're doing this semester. The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Yes, so The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe and The Lord of the Rings, I think both of those are wonderful books of great imagination and great literary merit. They won lots of secular literary awards, but they point you toward the vision of truth. Another book that I love that maybe at first glance doesn't seem like something that would be theological is George Eliot's novel Middlemarch. That is a book that points you in that direction. Anything by Dostoevsky points you in that direction. There's so many good ones. I've talked before on our summer reading nights in here about Elizabeth Googe, G-O-U-D-G-E, who's a British author that's kind of out of vogue right now, but she writes a lot of theologically informed fiction as well. Her book, Little White Horse, was what inspired J.K. Rowling to become a writer.
Yeah, so many of the classics that, you know, you mentioned.
The Wind and the Willows is another one.
Yeah, we've answered that question before, but that's pretty good.
This may apply to the last question, but what material would you suggest to read to the next generation to make sure imagination and empathy stay flowing?
Captain Underpants.
That, no. Definitely not Captain Underpants. I think Narnia is great. Beatrix Potter is such a sleeper. People don't even really know who Beatrix Potter is now, but she was a genius, and her stories will inspire a sense of wonder. And C.S. Lewis even talked about how Beatrix Potter had been one of the seminal influences in his life as a child because he had read Squirrel Nutkin. And Beatrix Potter's description of the coming of autumn was something that stayed with him for the rest of his life. So I think Beatrix Potter, Kenneth Graham, The Wind in the Willows, Lewis Carroll, Alice in Wonderland, all of those are really good. The Narnia stories, The Hobbit, all of those kinds of things are really, really important to read to the next generation. And if you can find a beautifully illustrated one, so much the better. Lewis was very deeply grateful to a woman named Pauline Baynes, and when he won some awards for Narnia, he was always very careful to say, Pauline Baynes and I won this award, because he thought her illustrations were almost as important in shaping the imagination as his words were.
Wow. You mentioned Andrew Peterson and The Rabbit Room. He has a series that we've read called The Wing Feather Saga,
yeah.
And there's a bunch of them. It's actually really great. Yeah, so that's another
and
one.
And Redwall is another that's really good.
Yeah.
These are great questions.
Should women take their husband's last name when they get married? Is it wrong if I don't want to?
This is why I love Theology on Tuesday.
Yes.
It's like we went from that to this.
Yes.
So what was the question? Was it wrong to take
is
the last
it,
name?
Is it wrong,
wrong
if I don't want
to.
If you don't want
say,
to.
Is it wrong if I don't want to take my husband's last name when I get married?
What do you think?
I think you can argue this either way. There certainly is no scriptural admonition that says that you need to do that. And in a lot of ways, it is a cultural thing. In many cultures that are traditionally Christian cultures, people don't do that. Like if you're in Spain, you end up with a hybrid last name. In France, you often don't do that. So I don't think that there is a spiritual no-no to that. I think part of it depends on the reasons that you might want to do that or not want to do that. I think there could be good reasons to not do it, and there could be bad reasons.
I'm gonna venture into some of those bad reasons. What might be some bad reasons for that is just, I think one of the biggest, we do a lot of premarital counseling, right? So if you're thinking, well, I'm going to, one of the things that's really important in any marriage is that you don't have like your stuff over here and their stuff over there. And I think that can be one of the reasons why it's like, no, I'm not fully giving myself over. And so that can be, that can manifest in so many different ways. If that's the reason, you might want to explore that. But I do just flag that. I agree completely with you. I don't think it's an absolute, you don't see any commands in scripture. It's a cultural thing. I will say just, and maybe, I don't know what they do in Spain, but I've often thought, because I had a lot of friends who got married and had like the hyphenated last name. And I always thought like, all right, if their children end up doing the same thing they did, and their children do the same thing they did, and their children, like, you're gonna have like 20 names by the end of it, and it's like, it's kind of.
But how cool would that be?
Maybe. I kind of thought it was.
You go to the DMV, and you're like, I need a new form.
What was more selfish turns into just a lot of handwriting, I think, at the end of the day. So, I don't know. It's not that. I don't think it's wrong to not want to necessarily. So, fascinating question. Next one.
Okay. How do we explain nature also being very cruel, especially when it comes to animal suffering?
Yes. So that is an excellent question. And one of the things that we believe in the Christian worldview is that nature and the creation are fallen. As well, and that death did not enter into the world until the fall. And so that originally in creation there was beauty and glory and all of that, but that there was not death and all of these other things. And it's interesting because if you read in some of Lewis's work, he talks about what you can deduce about God from just studying nature. And he said, you can deduce that God is a great artist, but you might also think God is unbelievably cruel just from looking at the way things happen. So I think that part of what we have to understand is that, as the book of Romans talks about in chapter 8, that the whole creation is groaning, longing for this renewal that will ultimately come in Christ. And you see that renewal described beautifully in Isaiah, in that passage where he says the lion will lie down with the lamb, you know, all of those kinds of images, and they will neither hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain. That's God's ultimate plan. So right now there are glorious beauties in nature, but there also is cruelty and seemingly random pain and suffering.
I've missed you, Brian, because I was right at Romans 8, right there, so often. So you just quoted exactly what I was
saying. It is amazing how much that happens, but it's a beautiful thing.
I would say also, and it's a great question, I would lean into why, like, if you're struggling with understanding, look at all the suffering in the world, especially animal cruelty, that was part of it. What do you mean by suffering? Why should it hurt you? If it's just an atheistic world, what's the whole, where do you get this idea of suffering? Where do you get this idea of right and wrong, right? And so lean into the fact that I know this is bad. I know this is wrong. And the thing is actually the Christian story explains it. Lewis would say it explains it better than anything else. Mm-hmm. And I would agree with him that God created the world, and as a result of man's choosing and aligning himself with the enemy, Satan, the world has come under a curse, and we see that both in our relationships, in ourselves, in our relationship with God, but also in the created world. And so the very evidence of suffering that we see, we can be assured that, yeah, this isn't the way it was meant to be. This is not the way, and that's a result of what we've done. It's not a result, it's not God's fault. He's allowed that to happen as a result of man's choice. And right. The great news is he doesn't abandon it. Just washed his hands clean of it. He's actually entered into that. He's suffered that same thing himself. He's undergone
in order to redeem it.
So it's not just God's done something about it, but he's intimately touched. And my favorite quote, this is, I can't remember it, but whatever it was, Dorothy Sayers, who said, whatever game God's playing with this world by suffering, he's had the courage to take his own medicine. And he's entered into it, and he's played fair because he knows what it's like to suffer as well.
Yeah.
And I think that's helped me when I've looked at the suffering, when I start to wonder, how can God be good and all powerful in this?
Great question.
Yeah.
When and after praying, do you have advice for trying to interpret what the Lord is telling you?
Yeah, that's a really good, I don't think we've ever had that question.
No, but that is a good question.
You want to go? I'm going to go. I'm going to jump ahead of you. All
right. Go right ahead.
So
you'll probably say what I was going to say anyway.
I think it's important. First of all, that's great. Going to the Lord and asking. I think one of the things, too, that I've learned is simply when you're going to the Lord and asking for Him to help lead you and provide guidance, one of the things the book of James says is ask Him, and He gives generously to those who want wisdom. And I think for me, I had a reluctance in listening that if God was going to reveal something and kind of nudge me in the direction to go, that He would I would resist the idea that He'd actually do that. And it was kind of silly, but actually He commands me to just go and ask them. So often I think it begins with, well, what do you think right after you prayed, right? What are the things that are coming to your mind? What are the circumstances around you that, by the way, He's orchestrating in your life? So be attentive to what you're thinking, what you're feeling, the situation around you after you have asked Him for prayer, right? And then also going to others who are Christians and ask them to pray with you and have the counsel of other people to where you can hear together what God's doing. I think we can get into trouble when we think we're hearing God say one thing, but then you ask like three wiser, older Christians and they're like, no, He's not saying that.
Not so much.
He reveals Himself in community. So I think that's
important. Yeah, I would agree with all that. And I think that one of the important things to keep in mind that is probably so obvious, I don't need to say it, but that God will never direct you to do something that is contrary to His revealed word. And so that is important. But I also think paying attention to circumstances and talking with older Christians who are people that you respect in terms of their walk with the Lord is really important. Another thing that I think can be very helpful in that discernment process is journaling. Because if you're journaling as you pray through something, you can actually sometimes see the Holy Spirit working in you, and that as you read back over what's happened over a couple of months, you can get a sense of what direction He's trying to point you in.
What do we have time for? At least one more.
How would you say that technology has improved or diminished imagination, such as types of media like TV shows or video games? Are these still viable?
I would say it has definitely reduced imagination in most ways, but it's encouraged it in a few. And I would say in terms of how it's reduced imagination, there's a great, again, if you're super nerdy, go read an essay by Lewis. It's called De Descriptione Temporum, which was his inaugural lecture at Cambridge University. But he has, I think, the most brilliant commentary on technology that has ever been written. And he says the real danger with technology is that, and he didn't know about iPhones, but if he had, he would have used them as the example, that when a new iPhone comes out, it is objectively better than the old iPhone. It does more things, it does them more quickly, its battery may last longer, the camera is better, and so, if you had the choice between an iPhone, I don't even know what number they're on now, 14 or whatever, if you had that versus an iPhone 4, it would be stupid to pick an iPhone 4. But he said the problem is that because that is true across the board and all these areas of technology that we become dependent on, whether it's a TV or a phone or whatever it might be, we have been conditioned to believe that anything that is old is therefore not as good as. And so we have written off everything that is old because it couldn't possibly be as good as these new things. And the problem with that is that a lot of the greatest works of the human spirit, the greatest works of the human imagination, are old, and so we write those off. The flip side of that is that For example, one of the things I love about technology is I love British choral music, which is sort of a narrow lane, I understand. But the great thing with technology is that I don't have to imagine looking at a printed score of music, what it would sound like to have that sung by a world-class choir. I can go onto YouTube and I can find King's College Cambridge singing that, and that's glorious, and that fires my imagination and my soul. So there are things like that. I think that there are things in video games and some of the storylines of some of the good ones, not Grand Theft Auto and its progeny, but some of the others that are more Lord of the Rings type things, that you get deeply involved in the storyline and that can produce some empathy. But I think part of the problem with most video games is there is an overemphasis on killing. That seems to be the point in a lot of them. So I think that is something that you have to push back against. Do you want to chime
in? Yeah, that's really good. Well, I think when you look at technology in general, Andy Crouch has a great book on this called The Techwise Family, but don't be thrown off by the word family. It's really short, really short. Andy Crouch, The Techwise Family. And what he talks about is technology. All technology is made so that life would be faster and easier, right? But that isn't actually the path to human flourishing necessarily, right? So take, for instance, the fact that you have access to the British choral music that you so love. You are able to play that with a click of a button. Up until very recently, when you had, I guess, music players when they were invented and all that, you had to learn how to play music. Mm-hmm. And to learn the scores and how to play an instrument and that sort of thing. And so actually one of the things that technology prohibits in some ways, right? Like, of course, how you use it and what it's for is always the most important thing, right? But there's a good, even in the access that you have to that sort of quality, what you miss out on is the joy of actually stretching yourself, putting in the hours and hours and years of work to be able to play something like that, and to be able to do that and the satisfaction that that provides, right? And I think that's one of the, even the goodness of technology, we have to note that it's always driving us to easier,
right,
and faster.
And there's always a downside.
And imagination,
yeah,
is not easy or fast.
Yeah.
It is always something that must be, it requires hard work and time, and I think that is one of the things we have to be aware of. Now, we have access to these great things, but they often can subvert what our ultimate goal is trying to be. Well, on that, thank you all for coming out. We're going to be back in 2 weeks. Lord willing, we'll be in the whiskey room over there, but I'm really excited. Our plan over the next few Theology on Tuesdays is to talk about friendships. We came across a couple great books, and we're going to do a little mashup of talking about friendships and what makes them work, what, and all that. So,
which we are so excited about.
Yes, yes, we are. So thank you all for coming out. We'll be around. Feel free to stick around and chat. Otherwise, we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Thanks for coming.